Welcome, Sons of America. Thank you for supporting digital piracy by listening to me. Let's begin with a moment of introspection so we can remind ourselves why we do not conform to this weak world of self-delusion, why our spiritual growth renews our souls, our hearts, and our minds on a daily basis, that we are only enlightened by accepting the harshest truths, and that the truth, no matter how frightening and horrible, only sets us free as our Creator truly wants us to be. These are the opening credits to Miller's Crossing, followed by selections of audio from the movie The Assassination of Jesse James by that dirty coward Robert Ford, the Colonial Anthem from Battlestar Galactica, and what I'd like to consider the theme song for the modern American rebel, The Geek Who Thinks Outside the Box, and a traditional American folk song for a special kind of farmer, my favorite kind of farmer, the corndog farmer.
He was growing into middle age and was living then in a bungalow on Woodland Avenue. He installed himself in a rocking chair and smoked a cigar down in the evenings as his wife wiped her pink hands on an apron and reported happily on their two children. His children knew his legs, the sting of his mustache against their cheeks. They didn't know how their father made his living, or why they so often moved. They didn't even know their father's name. He was listed in the city directory as Thomas Howard. And he went everywhere unrecognized and lunched with Kansas City shopkeepers and merchants, calling himself a cattleman or commodities investor. Someone rich and leisured who had the common touch. He had two incompletely healed bullet holes in his chest and another in his thigh. He was missing the nub of his left middle finger and was cautious lest that mutilation be seen. He also had a condition that was referred to as granulated eyelids, and it caused him to blink more than usual, as if he found creation slightly more than he could accept. Rooms seemed hotter when he was in them. Rains fell straighter. Clocks slowed. Sounds were amplified. He considered himself a Southern loyalist and guerrilla in a civil war that never ended. He regretted neither his robberies nor the 17 murders that he laid claim to. He had seen another summer under in Kansas City, Missouri. And on September 5th, in the year 1881, he was 34 years old.
right into this world all alone. God takes your soul, you're on your own. A crow flies straight, a perfect line. Gotta look this life in the eye. Some people like your cotton. Some people slop them hogs. Me, I do different. I grow big old fat corn dogs.
Now what we have is the Halo 3 soundtrack, but as background to the first part of the April 15, 2009 Rush Limbaugh show, followed by three MC Chris singles.
The James Gang committed over 25 bank, train, and stagecoach robberies from 1867 to 1881. But except for Frank and Jesse James, all the original members were now either dead or in prison. So for their last robbery at Blue Cut, the brothers recruited a gang of petty thieves and country rubes, culled from the local hillsides.
I just don't give a damn. I'm glad I fought against her. I only wish we'd won. I ain't asked any pardon for anything I done. I hate the Yankee Nation and everything they do. I hate the Declaration of Independence too. I hate the glorious Union, 'tis dripping with our blood. Hate this private banner, it is all I could. Ooh, I'm a good old river.
You know, I need to have direct access to the White House. I need an email address. I can just send them an email. Okay, I'm on the air. It's time to send the president out. Second day in a row, Obama, big major speech when his program starts. This is not coincidence. Obama talking about taxes. Simplifying the tax code. A bunch of BS. Greetings, my friends, and welcome. It's Rush Limbaugh, and this is the Excellence in Broadcasting Network. Great to have you here. Telephone number, if you want to join us today, 800-282-2882. The email address, lrushbo@eibnet.com. President Obama giving a speech here, talking about all his mythical tax cuts, how wonderful it's going to be for everybody, blah, 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 blah. His speech is going to go on for 10 to 15 minutes. We, however, can synthesize Obama's tax intentions in 60 seconds. Big Tea Party Day today, not just due to taxes, but due to the size of government and the loss of liberty. 500 locations in 50 states today. It's the Rush Limbaugh program on the EIB network. Coming up, a special message from President Obama. It is difficult to find, ladies and gentlemen, in American history, a time when so many liberals have spent so much time slinging so much mud on an embryonic movement. They are petrified and scared to death of the 500 tea parties scheduled for today in 50 American states. They're out there snarling, it was created by Fox News. It's a right-wing plot. This is all Limbaugh's doing. It's white people who are afraid of Obama. And that nutty professor from Princeton, Paul Krugman, it's backed by right-wing billionaires. Oh, even though that's BS, I guess it's okay if a movement is funded by George Soros. It's okay if MoveOn.org is behind it. But if it's a grassroots, bubble-up movement started entirely by average, ordinary, everyday Americans, and somehow it poses a great threat, and it's something that must be discredited, it's something that must be rained on, it's something that must be destroyed or at least interrupted and tampered with. And so the liberals who love the common man, the liberals, the American left, tell us daily, weekly, monthly, they are the ones looking out for the little guy. They now have to use every weapon at their command, from NBC to the New York Times to the Obama database to the Twitter crowd, to mock, smear, and trash what is real democracy. What is real democracy is occurring in 50 states, in 500 different locations, and the American left standing for the little guy, hoping and making, protecting the little guy from the onslaught of disaster. They have to go out and destroy these people, to mock them, to smear them, to trash them. Because it is real democracy, it is the expression of individual liberty and freedom and the clamor for more, which is upsetting to no end to Barack Obama, the Democrat Party, and the American left. You want to do a Million Man March? No problem. You want to have a Move On protest or Code Pink panties showing up in any congressional hearing room? No problem. Ditto. You want Cindy Sheehan and her two dozen protesters outside Bush's house? No problem. That's democracy at work. You want the Democrat Party urging defeat for the U.S. military, echoed by the drive-by media? You want, that's fine, that's democracy at work, but real people getting together because of real issues that frighten them and alarm them about the security that they feel they're not going to have in the future and the very structure of their country, let that happen? Oh no, that is not to be tolerated. That is to be destroyed. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the new era of hope and change, a new era of genuine hope, of genuine change, not backed by Move On, not funded by George Soros, not supported by Al Sharpton's busloads. These tea parties today are springing up all over the country, and various people are being blamed. The Heritage Foundation has a report today that Dick Armey is being blamed by the Center for American Progress for this. Paul Krugman is blaming me and Tom DeLay for this. Blaming! Liberal pundits, liberal special interest organizations blaming various people for the outpouring of genuine sentiment that is born of love of country and devotion to the nation's founding. The truth is, these tea parties are a completely grassroots movement. There is no specific leader or origin. I mean, you might be able to say that Rick Santelli of CNBC on February 16th, talking about a tea party, led to this. But and you might want to say that that somebody in the media or their politicians trying to claim credit for it, which is standard operating procedure. Some media people trying to claim credit for it, that's standard operating procedure as well. But this is a genuine bubble-up movement from what is commonly called the grassroots. Front page of USA Today today has a headline: most Americans okay with big government, at least for now. That's bogus. USA Today reports that even though many Americans are supportive of what President Obama has done so far by a 55-32% margin, Americans still say they worry more about big government. So have at it, those of you at the tea parties. There are all kinds of rumors that Acorn and other subversive groups loyal to President Obama are going to be out there trying to disrupt these things. maybe create racial incidents, maybe create chaos to make it appear as though the people gathering at the tea parties are the equivalent of angry left-wing mobs that blow up banks and try to destroy private property. Let's go. By the way, this is grab audio soundbite number 4. On the fly. This is on C-SPAN today. Washington Journal host Steve Scully talking to Faj. Some guy named Shakir from Think Progress. Steve Scully says, what do you think the aftermath of all this will be, the result, if anything?
If there's a large number of people who show up, it's Fox News protesters against Obama at the end of the day. Obama's got an agenda here, and what we shouldn't forget is that Rush Limbaugh, who said he hopes Obama fails, this is now the fruition of that effort. For those people who are hoping that Obama fails and actively plotting for his failure, this is what this effort is trying to do, and I hope that the majority of the American public who agree with where President Obama stands and where he wants to take this country understand that this is an effort that's simply trying to derail that.
No, they're not trying to derail failure. Derail failure. They want failure. He's exactly right about that. These are people, and they're not all Republicans. There are some Obama supporters out there. Neil Cavuto's out in Sacramento, my adopted hometown. There's some Obama supporters there. Not a whole lot, but some who have said this is not what they thought they were getting. So there's a cross-section of America represented by participants at the Tea Party. But of course they want him to fail. I mean, we're going to get into this in a moment as the program unfolds. He's trying. And he made it plain yesterday in his speech, he wants an entirely new foundation on which to build the United States and the U.S. economy. A new foundation. We've already got a foundation. It's called the Constitution. The Constitution of the United States is a foundation. He wants a new foundation. We'll have details as the program unfolds before your very eyes and ears. One more soundbite. Chuck Todd, stenographer for the Obama administration, disguised as an NBC reporter, on the Today Show today, a portion of his report.
Today, the White House is hoping to use the tax day deadline as a backdrop to highlight another part of his economic plan, that signature middle-class tax cut. Republicans, meanwhile, are struggling to make use of the day politically. There's been some grassroots conservatives who have organized so-called tea parties around the country, hoping the historical reference will help galvanize Americans against the president's economic ideas. But the idea hasn't really caught on. The RNC has jumped in. A few other talk radio hosts have jumped in. But it hasn't galvanized the party the way they would hope.
It has nothing to do with the Republican Party, Chuck. One of the reasons the Tea Parties have sprung up is because the Republican Party is hibernating. One of the reasons it's sprung up is because these people have turned to themselves for leadership because they can't find any in the fiefdom of Washington, D.C. We'll take a break and be right back. Well, peace is breaking out all over the area, patrolled by the Somali Merchant Marine organizers. I don't know what else you would describe this as. Somali pirates vowed to hunt down American ships and kill their sailors. And French forces detained 11 other brigands in a high seas raid as tensions ratcheted up today off Africa's volatile eastern coast. Pirates fired grenades and automatic weapons at an American freighter loaded with food aid, but the ship escaped, for those of you in Rio Linda, and was heading to Kenya under a U.S. Navy guard. Somali pirates vowing now to hunt down and kill Americans. After three black teenagers were shot down by the Obama administration on Sunday in the Gulf of Aden. From the Wall Street Journal, headline, banks ramp up foreclosures. I saw that and I said, what? This is not supposed to be happening. We had all kinds of Obama speeches. We had Obama just last week, or maybe it was the week before, with his new mortgage calculator website, where you could call and find out where you could get help if you couldn't make your mortgage payment. And it was like a salesman. You don't trust any other businesses offering you this. Just go to us. So I read further. Some of the nation's largest mortgage companies are stepping up foreclosures on delinquent homeowners. That'll likely lead to more Americans losing their homes, just as the Obama administration's housing rescue plan gets into gear. JPMorgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac all say that they have increased foreclosure activity in recent weeks. Those companies say they've lifted internal moratoriums, which temporarily halted foreclosures. Now, they did this starting at the tail end of last year as a PR gesture to the Obama administration. And, of course, they were getting ripped across the over the coals by the media and everybody else, Wall Street banks, big banks, they're getting bailouts and so forth. So they relaxed their standards, but it hasn't helped. And everybody knew it wasn't going to help. You cannot have people who are owed money say, okay, you don't have to pay us back. And have those people stay in business and be solvent. It's not going to happen. Some mortgage companies had stopped foreclosing on borrowers as they waited for details of the administration's housing rescue plan, which was announced in February, provides incentives for mortgage companies and investors to reduce borrowers' payments to affordable levels. And that's never going to work either. You don't have the arbitrary hand of government reaching into the free market saying, okay, look, you've got to lower your mortgage terms. No more, the mortgage terms were what they were. The cost of money is what it was. The cost of money is what it is. Well, you got to make those payments cheaper for people. You just can't. Not how it works. Not on a mass basis. Now they've begun to determine which troubled borrowers are candidates for help and to move the rest through the foreclosure process. The resulting increase in the supply of foreclosed homes could further depress home prices and put additional pressure on bank earnings as troubled loans are written off. Some of the mortgage companies are themselves receiving funds under the government's financial sector bailout, which could make their actions politically sensitive. But mortgage companies say that they are taking steps to keep borrowers in their homes and are only resorting to foreclosures when there are no other options. When there are no other options. I don't care how you slice this. The banks are foreclosing on more and more customers, and the Obama himself, in numerous speeches the first quarter of this year, has indicated this wasn't going to happen. And he had all kinds of plans in place to make sure that there was insurance against this kind of thing happening. If you're in your home, they're going to make sure you stay in your home. It's not working out. Real world experience. How many people are going to be foreclosed on who thought that it would never happen because of Obama? And then what will their reaction be? My guess is their reaction will be, he doesn't know this is happening. This is all the bank's fault. Obama wouldn't do this to us. It's not his problem. Brace yourselves for that. It's what the media will report. You know, I want to go back to this DHS Homeland Security report on the right-wing extremists and the dangers that they pose to the Obama administration and the United States of America, because I thought there's a portion of this thing that looked familiar to me. And by the way, as I pointed out yesterday, this is not from Janet Napolitano. This DHS report that maligns and impugns conservatives as right-wing extremists is straight from Obama. It's straight from his heart. It's straight from his head. It is precisely how he views anybody who opposes him. And I think I can illustrate that here. Here's the part of the report that looked familiar to me, that rang bells, that raised red flags. The Department of Homeland Security Office of Intelligence and Analysis has no specific information that domestic right-wing terrorists are currently planning acts of violence, but right-wing extremists may be gaining new recruits by playing on their fears about several emergent issues. The economic downturn, the election of the first African-American president, present unique drivers for right-wing radicalization and recruitment. They also mentioned immigration in this. Now, this sounds to me very close to something Obama said during the campaign. And it was at that San Francisco fundraiser about the bitter clingers. Let's review that. Here's what he said. But the truth is, our challenge is to get people persuaded we can make progress when there's not evidence of that in their daily lives. You go into some of these small towns in Pennsylvania, and like a lot of small towns in the Midwest, The jobs have been gone now for 25 years and nothing's replaced them. And they fell through with the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, and each successive administration has said that somehow these communities are going to regenerate, and they haven't. So it's not surprising then that they get bitter. They cling to guns or religion or antipathy to people who aren't like them or anti-immigrant sentiment or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations. Well, that's, you talk about a foundation, that is an excellent foundation upon which this DHS report on right-wing extremists could be built. Bitter clingers, angry, people don't look like they do, immigration, anti-trade. So don't think this is Janet Napolitano, folks. This is Barack Obama. The White House, by the way, this is, let me find this here because it's somewhat comical out there. The White is from the Washington Times today. The White House has distanced itself from the Homeland Security analysis when asked for comment on its contents. White House spokesman Nick Shapiro said the following. The president is focused not on politics, but rather taking the steps necessary to protect all Americans from the threat of violence and terrorism, regardless of its origins. He also believes those who serve represent the best of this country, meaning the military, and he'll continue to ensure that our veterans receive the respect and benefits they have earned. Now, how in the name of Sam Hill does the president of the United States get away with distancing himself from his own administration? The White House distanced itself from the analysis. It's the Department of Homeland Security. He put Janet Napolitano in there. Janet Napolitano is a Janet Reno. And this guy gets to, he comes out in the White House and he's distancing himself from his own administration. Well, I didn't know that. It's just like the call we had from, yeah, if only Obama knew. If only Obama had known that this was going to be reported. He loves veterans. That's the only thing about it he didn't correct. I love veterans. They're going to continue to be, if only Obama knew. Just like the foreclosure thing, certainly. Once these people start getting foreclosed on, people that believed Obama said it wouldn't happen, I'm sure Obama doesn't know. This is the evil banks. This is the evil banks. And Obama didn't know, but yet he's in control. He's in charge. He provides the vision. This man is in charge of change and hope, and he's got everything under control. He's competent. He's elegant. But he doesn't know what's going on in his own Department of Homeland Security. Ha! To the phones. People want to weigh in. Dayton, Ohio. We'll start with Rob. Great to have you on the program, sir. Hello.
Hello, Rush. I wanted to just call and thank you for helping to set the record straight on this Tea Party movement. You're exactly right. I first became involved in it about a month ago. It's a grassroots movement. People like me who felt not only appalled at the shift towards socialism, but have also felt disenfranchised by the Republican Party. And heretofore, we've just gone about our lives. We've just provided for our families and our communities and didn't want to get involved in politics. And when we see the freedom that we've had to pursue that is about to be taken away from us, it's people like me that said we just have to finally get involved before it's too late. And it's not about party lines. We don't care. It's
someone Let me ask you some questions.
Sure, go ahead, Rush.
Are you a neo-Nazi?
Absolutely not.
Do you hate black people?
Absolutely not.
Do you hate illegal immigration?
Illegal immigration? I think that immigrants should be helped to become citizens, U.S. citizens.
Okay.
I find that if immigrants that come in this country, especially ones I've seen from Mexico, are some of the hardest working people I've seen.
Okay, I just wanted to get your profile because you and people like you are going to be smeared and impugned today in ways that it's never happened to you. And it, in fact, you have been already in media reports prior to this happening. But, you know, about people trying to take credit, this is something that it's just human nature, especially politicians or wannabe politicians see something like this and they can't wait to become part of it. They can't wait to glom onto it. I remember Dan's bake sale. Dan's bake sale, which was in the early 90s out in Fort Collins, Colorado. And there were 65 or 75,000 people showed up. When I got out there, practically every Colorado elected official was there, too. Now, they didn't claim any credit for it, but they wanted to be involved. They wanted to make speeches. So this is it's natural. It's normal human nature. You get some media people who want to claim they have something to do with this, too, because they believe that this is the way to reach out from outside studio to build up and promote audience and so forth. But look, everybody knows, I think, that this is what makes this great is how you described it. This is real people. This is real democracy bubbling up. This did not have to be inspired. It did not have to be promoted. It did not have to be created. This rage and this fear and the anger that people have and the desire to fix this and hold on to the founding principles of the country is real.
Well, I don't know if I call it rage, Rush. I think it's more that people just decided, you know what, we just got to get in the game. We sat in the sidelines long enough. And it's time for our voices to be heard.
Don't be afraid of people saying that you're angry about that. I'm angry. I can't tell you how angry I am over with. I heard just a little bit about what Obama said in his tax speech. It's outrageous. It ticks me off like you can't believe. It makes me livid. Everything that he's trying to do makes me livid. And I'm not going to apologize for being angry about it. I don't care who tries to mischaracterize. It's a genuine emotion, for crying out loud, for talking about the United States of America. We're talking about our foundation of the Constitution. We're talking about preserving this country as it was founded, children, grandchildren, ad infinitum. And we're up against somebody who wants to totally remake it, tear it apart, rebuild it with a new foundation that does not have the Constitution anywhere involved or very little involved. So I know you're sensitive to this whole thing being driven by rage, but if there's not some anger involved here, this wouldn't be happening. I'm just saying, don't be afraid to admit that. You're going to be mischaracterized no matter what you do. You could show up singing peace songs. You could show up in togas. And smoking some dope, and they're still gonna call. You guys could sing hymns. You could be like monks. You could go out there and just never say a word. Just show up in silent protest. They're still gonna call you dangerously deranged, angry, blah, bitter clingers, and so forth. You're gonna get impugned and maligned no matter what you do. So be who you are. We'll be back. Have you heard about Ron Paul's idea on dealing with the Somali merchant marine organizer pirates? It's not just Ron Paul, by the way. There's a growing number of national security experts are calling on Congress, which means this will never happen, to consider using letters of marque and reprisal, which is a power written into the Constitution that allows the United States to hire private citizens to keep international waters safe. It was used heavily during the Revolution and the War of 1812. Letters of marque and reprisal serve as official warrants from the government, allowing privateers, think Blackwater, to seize or destroy enemies, their loot, and their... Think, if you watch 24, think Starkwood. That's if you... Are you watching 24, Dawn? Duh! Then you don't know what Starkwood is. But Starkwood is 24's version of Blackwater. And they're trying to blow up missiles with nerve gas all over America because the president's trying to shut them down. At any rate, so letters of marque and reprisal are warrants, official warrants from the government, allowing privateers to seize or destroy enemies, their loot, and their vessels in exchange for bounty money. So basically, letters of marque and reprisal allow you to hire bounty hunters out there. You keep your military out of it where they can go do their Meals on Wheels things. The letters also require would-be thrill seekers, that would be the privateers, to post a bond promising to abide by international rules of war. And theoretically here, hiring bounty hunters, private citizens to go out there and deal with the pirates would be a cheaper option than dealing with the U.S. military. So that is Ron Paul's idea on dealing with this. Have a couple of audio sound bites from President Obama's Tax Day message, which basically was suck up and pay up. The message is basically suck it up and pay up. He brought a parade of victims up there who we all support with our taxes.
I know that April 15th is not exactly everyone's favorite date on the calendar.
Damn right about that.
It is an important opportunity for those of us in Washington to consider our responsibilities to the people who sent us here and who pay the bills. Across America, families like the people who joined me have had tough choices forced upon them because of this economic downturn. These Americans are the backbone of our middle class. They need a government that is working to create jobs and opportunity for them rather than simply giving more and more to those at the very top in the false hope that wealth automatically trickles down.
I'll tell you this. You talk about rage and anger. I'm getting to the point here where I'm not going to be able to contain myself. Have you ever gotten a job from a poor person? This trickle-down, this is criticism of trickle-down, Reaganomics, supply side, whatever, ongoing effort to discredit the economic policies that created a 25-year economic boom. And he's just said it. These people, they depend on you paying taxes to us rather than building your own businesses. These people, these sad sack victims he paraded up there as victims of the economic downturn that only government can fix. He parades them up there and says, you need to be paying more taxes to help these people. This government trickle-down, this private trickle-down, this rich trickle-down, a rich trickle-down doesn't work. My God, folks, that is such an out-and-out lie, and it's so easily demonstrated. It's demonstrated. Remember the luxury tax on yachts? All that happened was the people who worked building yachts were fired, were laid off, because nobody bought yachts. Then when they got rid of the tax, people were able to buy yachts again. People were hired. Trickle-down works every time it's tried. What he tries to make you think trickle-down is that the rich are going to walk around and give money away to the middle class and the poor, like government does. There's no concept. He knows exactly what he's talking about, too. And he's bitter. This guy is an angry, bitter guy, and he has as his intention to return the nation's wealth to its rightful owners, and the rightful owners of the nation's wealth are not the nation's producers, in his view. The nation's producers have committed crimes. The nation's producers are greedy and selfish, and they need to be gotten even with. They need to be cut down to size, just like he intends to cut this country down to size. And so, suck it up and pay up on tax day. Learn to like the fact that your increased tax dollars are going to pay people that don't work. And they can't work because they have been destroyed by the capitalist economy going south. And the only way we can fix it is for government to get involved. Here's another item, soundbite, what he said.
For too long, we've seen taxes used as a wedge to scare people into supporting policies that actually increased the burden on working people instead
of
helping them.
Stop the tape. I want you to recue this to the this is really going to make me explode because this is such an out and out lie. Taxes have been used as a wedge to scare people. And that's just utter BS. The whole point of taxes and the opposition to onerous taxes, for which we get apparently nothing. I mean, it's one thing to pay your, you know, go in and buy something, pay something for it and get it. But what are you getting for your taxes now? You're getting a reformation of government. You're getting a mountain of debt. You're getting your kids born broke. And your grandkids born broke. Now listen to this.
For too long, we've seen taxes used as a wedge to scare people into supporting policies that actually increase the burden on working people instead of helping them live their dreams. And that has to change. And that's the work that we've begun. We've passed tax cuts that will help our economy grow. We've made a clear promise that families that earn less than $250,000 a year will not see their taxes increase by a single dime.
Lie.
We've given tax relief to the Americans who need it and the workers who have earned it. So, on this April 15th, we're reminded of the enormous responsibility that comes with handling people's tax dollars. And we're renewing our commitment to a simpler tax code that rewards work and the pursuit of the American dream.
You earn less than $250,000 in smoke. If you earn $250,000 a year and pay utility bills, if you earn $250,000 a year and have a cell phone or two, your taxes are not going down. And even federal income taxes, you're going to be hit because everybody's taxes are going up. We've given tax relief to the Americans who need it. Half the country no longer pay income taxes. Half the country no longer pay it. We've already given tax relief to people who quote-unquote need it. And the workers who've earned it? What? How do you earn a tax cut in this man's perverted mind and world? You earn a tax cut by not paying it. We'll be back. Matt Lauer on the Today Show today, very frightened that American business, after giving back TARP money, will go back to running themselves and will not allow themselves to be run by government. He is worried about the calamity that would result. All that and much more coming right up after this.
In my DeLorean, war is over, I'm a peace time Mandalorian. The story is stumped, Star Wars historian. Steven debate, but they play at Benegans. Rhyme renegade, show to penetrate. First and second defense, I won't hesitate. Got a job to do when Darth the guy but delegates. Got something against Skywalker, someone he really hates. I don't give a fuck, I'm after Solo. For all I carry, could be Han at Yoda's dojo. Gotta make the money, credit's no good when a Jawa's run a shop in your neighborhood. Think you can cook, I got a grappling hook. Let's make this quick, cause I'm really booked. I'm a devious, degenerate defender of the devil. Shunting all the trash compactors on the detention level. My backpack's got jets. Well, I'm Boba, the Fett. Well, I bounty hunt for Jabba Hutt to finance my vet. Well, I chill in deep space. A mask is over my face. Well, I deliver the prize, but I still narrow my eyes. Cause my time I don't like to waste. Get down! I'm a question, rap inside Enigma. Get inside a slave one, find your home and signal. From Endor to Hoth, Ripley to Spock. What you want, but there's gonna be a cost. Say my name is Boba Fett, I know my shit is tight. Start acting right, yo, fuzz on a carbonite. Got telescopic sight, flamethrowers on my wrist. You still don't get the gist, spike boots made a kick. Targets are made a hit, you think I give a shit? Your mama is a bitch, I see you in the Sarlacc pit. You just flipped my switch, integrity's been ditched. You scratching on my itch, you know I shoot again. I got the bean and secatinas waiting to lick my lusty lips. So I'll let you get back inside your little spaceship. Give you a head start, cause I'm a sporting con. Consider the starting line and stinky smile hot inside. Hope you have hyperdrive. Cause I never take a bribe. To the beat of a different drama. Baddest bunny hunter. Let no man put us under. Or Ellie be put under. As in 6 feet. Got an imperial fleet backing me up. Gonna blow up any attempt to defeat. They got a death star. Got full payments on my car. Handed over to Hammerhead. At most I see bar. Used to carjack him. He's a bar back. Just go to show how you can get back on the right track. Guess for me that's not an option. Can't say that with more clarity. Me going legit would be like Jar Jar with speech therapy. My backpack's got jets. Well I'm Boba, the Fett. Well I bounty hunt for Jabba Hutt to finance. Will I chill in deep space? A mask is over my face. Will I deliver the prize? But I still narrow my eyes. Cause my time I don't like to waste. Get down! I sit open like a tauntaun, faster than the Autobahn. Or a motorbike, a tron. Do the deed, I'm living gone. Jabba has a hit fit. Contact Corinthian. Overcoat the flannel, photo politic. It's legit. Back in the day when I was a slave, living life in a fast lane, like in a pod race. Mean street tweak, that became a best in case. So the space age, put that place post haste. Took up a noble cause, called a Clone Wars. Lifestyle all about girls and cars. So scar, a cold black heart that's been torn apart. The Sith wish that they had a dick so hard. Cause it's long, long ago when I pussy far, far. Call me master, cause I'm faster to pry on far. I no longer have to hot wire. I'm a hunter for hire with no plans to retire. And all the sucker MCs can't call me sire. My backpack's got jets. Well, I'm Boba the Fett. Well, I bounty hunt for Jabba Hutt.
Why kids love hip-hop?
Kids love hip hop and Axl, tractors and Rambo, playing armor tournament with infinite ammo. Taggers and vandals, and black socks and sandals, doing as many drugs as they can motherfucking handle. Skipping school, breaking rules, and flipping the bird. Fast food cartoons after eating some herb. Freaking them flirts, making them purl at hearts. Just a couple of nerds, clocking the cards, a couple of words about Manila Wiggers. Packing pitas that are measured in millimeters. We don't talk in the theaters like with Siskel and Ebert. We drink box wine, and we listen to Weezer. Come on.
Rope swings busted, thinking cops always kicking me out of the park. Manager of the 7-Eleven always saying, get off my curb, you good for nothing. All the girls already know I'm a bad kisser, so they won't come anywhere near me. I don't know how many times I've been TGIF. A kid can eat an onion bloom only so many times. Bowling's boring, the skating rink's been taken over by 12-year-olds. There ain't no good movies out. Blockbuster never had any good games in. I don't wanna play Bombad Racing. I mean, what the heck is that? I'm sick of all my records, and every time I walk into a record store, I forget what I wanna get. And there ain't nothing on TV, not a stupid thing. There ain't nothing to do except take naps and wait patiently for death. Why kids love hip hop? Why kids love hip hop? Why kids love hip hop? Wang. Oh, bullshit.
MC, can I have your autograph?
Sure, kid. I'm in a real hurry. What's your name?
It's Mikey.
Okay, Mikey.
MC, I hope I have a real high voice like you said.
What's my name, MC? And what do I do? Rap. MD screaming, need 50 cc's of MC stat. ER savvy, freaking like Mariah or no rag. MC Chris, squeezing contact out of tiny plastic bag. It's like hypnotizing eyes and getting digits on the pad. Like separate like hyphens because MC's still the back. Identify the items by the barcode on the tag. Identify the rapper because he's needy in the badge. I got my Glocks cocked. I got my nines primed. I got my crosses locked in Kelly LeBrock's behind. I got my lungs locked in chemotherapy kind. I got my rhymes, show Silver Sun and Shakespeare combined. So I sound like a 10-year-old, or so I've been told. But you don't need a voice slow to make the microphone go. All this claim that they be modest, but they got laryngitis. So what you can't get with the MC with the voice is the highest.
Fucking rapper.
What's my name, MC? And what do I do? Rock. I'm intimidating jocks and inseminating socks. And I'm infiltrating flocks of fembots. High off that hemlock. Mud wrestling bitty buttocks like ox. And snark chucks cause we can't afford boots. Let's get high, aka pole tubes. Don't ask why, just let it all loose. Watch this mic get abused. Watch me change your attitude. Call me Gavin, I'm the captain of this carnival cruise. Kathy Lee lets me rub my dick on her boots. Seems tweens and cleavage jeans is many a man's muse. All MC needs is just a bucket of booze. And watch me blow a load on your butt tattoo. Watch me come back for seconds like it's Chinese food. No one can hear you scream cause it's a soundproof room. I'm done, get the fuck out, send it number two. I sound like a 10-year-old.
Then ancient Roman symphony played on actual ancient Roman instruments called the Sonalia plays background to a short historical lecture on Xenophon's Persian expedition. otherwise known as the March of the 10,000. Think Battlestar Galactica for ancient Spartan mercenaries. Only, it's all true. Finally, we finish off with some late 60s stand-up from the master of comedy, Don Rickles, because there is nothing more rebellious than laughter.
Lecture 14, The March of the 10,000.
Having surveyed the disaster that befell the Athenians in Sicily in the last lecture, this time we consider another Greek expedition overseas that got off to a bad start but ended well. This is the March of the 10,000, the extraordinary adventure of a group of Greek mercenaries who marched into the heart of the Persian Empire, fought a very strange battle, and then marched back out again. We start with two necessary preliminaries, the administration of the Persian Empire and the growth of mercenary service among the Greeks. We have seen already how the great king sat at the center of the Persian state, a despotic spider in the middle of an administrative web. But on the ground, the empire was quite decentralized. It was subdivided into large provinces called satrapies, under governors called satraps, who were often relatives of the great king, brothers, sons, or nephews, or cousins. Beneath the satraps were arrayed a variety of officials, city governors, and even village headmen called comarchs. In some areas, native kings were left in control of their ancestral lands, though subordinate to Persian authority. The satraps and client kings were given a wide latitude of action. They could raise their own armies, conduct their own foreign affairs, and even wage wars against each other. Such wars appeared to have been accepted by the great king, so long as they remained small-scale and regional. The chief concern of the central authorities was the collection of tribute for the king. The maintenance of peace and order seems to have been a secondary consideration. The king kept a lid on all this in a variety of ways. Throughout his realm, a network of spies reported to a court official named the King's Eye, a sort of Persian domestic intelligence czar. Uncertainty helped keep everyone on their toes. At any time, without warning and without any justification, a satrap or a client king could be removed from office, reassigned, or made subordinate to a neighbor. The empire was also dotted with royal zoological parks called paradisoi, the origin of our word paradise, where the king could enjoy a staged hunt. But the paradisoi also allowed the king to show up unannounced in any locality that housed one. With one exception, all Persian dynastic transfers of power since Cyrus the Great had established the empire in the mid-6th century BC were attended by conflict between claimants. Darius I, the man who had met defeat at Marathon, was himself a usurper. A change of king was a delicate time in Persia. In Greece, meanwhile, incessant internal discord ensured a certain quorum of adventurous spirits who would choose to make a living in war. As early as the 7th century BC, Greek mercenaries are attested in Egypt, carving their names onto the great monument of Rameses II at Abu Simbel. Many known Greek mercenaries hail from Arcadia and Achaea, both impoverished regions of the northern Peloponnese, which suggests desperation may have impelled many into mercenary service. However, the unstable conditions in Greece during and after the Peloponnesian War generated plenty of potential recruits from other regions of Greece, and the great wealth and the internal fractiousness characteristic of the Persian Empire provided natural employers. The March of the 10,000 was to be a product of these two conditions combined. Greek mercenaries came in various shapes and sizes. Hoplites, given their demonstrated effectiveness, were much in demand. There were also specialized troops such as slingers from Rhodes or archers from Crete. By 401 BC, a new form of soldier had become prevalent, the peltast. Originating in Thrace and named after the small, light shield that they carried called the pelte, peltasts were fast, lightly armored, and equipped with javelins and short swords. They made excellent skirmishers and were most effective when used in support of the hoplite phalanx. The 10,000 was to include 2,000 such peltasts. Our account of the 10,000's amazing adventure comes from one of its members, Xenophon the Athenian, who was invited to go along by one of the commanders of the expedition. At the time, Xenophon was in his late 20s. His precise role in the expedition is unclear, since he himself says at one point that he was neither general, nor captain, nor common soldier. The essential feature of his account, called the March Up Country, or the Anabasis in Greek, is that it comes from an eyewitness. This does not mean that Xenophon tells the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, but it at least gives his record an authority often lacking in ancient literature. Memoirs were written by other participants in the expedition and are echoed in other sources, but Xenophon's account is the fullest and is the main source for what follows. Xenophon lays out the internal Persian backdrop for the expedition. When Darius II died in 404 BC, he left the kingdom to his son, Artaxerxes. Darius had previously appointed a younger son named Cyrus to the rich and important satrapy of Western Asia with its capital at Sardis. So Cyrus had had extensive dealings with the Greeks, in particular with the Spartans, as they sought Persian financial aid in bringing the Peloponnesian War to a successful conclusion, which they did in 404 BC. Cyrus's appointment to Western Asia, however, had displaced the incumbent satrap, Tissaphernes, who now governed only a portion of his former realm. He was basically demoted. This fact, Tissaphernes resented. So when Artaxerxes succeeded to the throne in 404, Tissaphernes immediately accused Cyrus before the new king, his own brother. Xenophon, an admirer of Cyrus, presents the charge as wholly baseless, but we cannot be so sure. Neither was Artaxerxes, evidently, since he imprisoned Cyrus and would have executed him had their mother not intervened and negotiated Cyrus's release. Cyrus then returned to Sardis, now resentful and justifiably worried about his future. Cyrus is presented by Xenophon as a man of his word, who never failed to honour a promise or to enrich a friend. He was charming and charismatic. By such means, he made his satrapy loyal to himself, and using his great wealth, he began raising an army of Persians and Greek mercenaries. There was an exiled Spartan named Clearchus, whom Xenophon presents as gloomy by nature, laconic, rough in his habits, and tough in his treatment of others. To this man, Cyrus gave a huge sum of money as a sign of his admiration. Clearchus promptly used the money to raise an army of Greek mercenaries, which he then took on campaign in Thrace. Xenophon reckoned that Clearchus simply loved war. As he puts it, "When he may enjoy peace without dishonor or harm, he chooses war. When he may live in idleness, he prefers toil, provided it is the toil of war. When he may keep his money without risk, he elects to diminish it by carrying on war." This Clearchus then created the core of the 10,000 as his own private army, which became incorporated into Cyrus's larger mixed Persian and Greek expeditionary force. The 10,000 was a motley crew of toughies from various parts of the Greek world, including Athens, Sparta, Arcadia, Achaea, Boeotia, Rhodes, Crete, and Thrace, so a real mixed bag of people. They were organized under five generals, the chief of these being Clearchus. Below the generals were 20 captains. If there were other officers besides these in the original command structure, Xenophon doesn't deign to mention them. It seems reasonable to assume that each general commanded about 2,000 men and each captain 500. There are references to younger and to older soldiers, but no precise age groups can be determined. The whole force is reckoned by Xenophon as initially comprised of 11,000 hoplites and 2,000 peltasts, but it is usually referred to just as the 10,000. In addition, Cyrus raised a Persian force numbered by Xenophon at 100,000, both cavalry and infantry. 100,000 is far too large a total on the face of it, but no reliable sources exist to provide us with alternative figures. Despite his supposedly noble character, Cyrus was not truthful about his intentions. He told his Greek mercenaries and a suspicious Tissaphernes that he was raising the army to tackle raiders in the eastern part of his satrapy. But he also told King Artaxerxes that his muster was part of his ongoing fight with Tissaphernes. The fractious Persian administration allowed these deceptions to be deemed plausible. But Tissaphernes wasn't buying Cyrus's story. When he learned the scale of his preparations, he warned Artaxerxes that a rebellion was afoot and the king began making counter-preparations. The suspicions of the Greeks were not allayed by Cyrus's cover story either. As they marched ever eastward, they finally approached Cyrus about his intentions, demanding extra pay if, as they suspected, they were going against the king. Cyrus lied in response. He insisted they were only policing the eastern borders of his satrapy, but he promised them extra pay anyway. As the eastward march put the lie to Cyrus's pretense, some units deserted. Cyrus only announced his true intentions when the force had reached the upper Euphrates River, far beyond the eastern borders of his satrapy. He was attacking his brother to seize the throne, he announced. With promises of yet more bounty on success, the Greeks were persuaded to stay on board. The 10,000, hired under false pretenses, were now willing participants in a war to overthrow the great king of Persia. The cost to themselves, if defeated, would be total. Artaxerxes was unlikely to countenance the survival of hired rebels. Indeed, he would be keen to make an example of them as a deterrence. Every one of them could expect protracted and painful deaths if captured. All their eggs were now in one basket. Cyrus's victory would surely bring great riches from a new and grateful great king, but defeat would bring almost certain death. Before reaching the Euphrates, Cyrus had hosted a visit from the queen of Cilicia named Epiaxa. The queen requested a review of Cyrus's army. Rumor had it that she had been reviewing other of Cyrus's assets on a regular basis too. The Greeks formed up in their phalanx. Cyrus and Epiaxa, in chariots, stood themselves facing the Greek line. Cyrus gave the order to advance. The Greeks, all shining bronze and bobbing crests, issued their Paean war song and moved forward, gradually increasing their pace until they broke into a full charge. The sight and sound was so terrifying that Epiaxa turned her car about and fled. Visitors at market in the nearby camp also turned tail. This humorous event proved to be an omen of the future, for at the coming Battle of Cunaxa, the strength of the Greeks was to be the source of all their troubles. By September 401 BC, Cyrus's daring advance into the heart of the Persian Empire had entered its final stages. He advanced down the Euphrates River to a point about 45 miles north of Babylon. There, word finally arrived that Artaxerxes was in the area. Spoor of the royal army could be seen all about, as well as some recently dug trenches, but the enemy himself remained elusive. After 3 days of slow advance, a scout reported that the king was approaching with a vast horde, with Xenophon numbers at over 1 million men, a plainly ridiculous figure. Even if the absolute figures remain uncertain, there can be no doubt about the relative strength of the two sides. Cyrus was vastly outnumbered by Artaxerxes. The 10,000 had marched for about 6 months from their starting point in western Turkey to reach Babylonia. Now crunch time had arrived, and they were some 1,766 miles inside enemy territory. Cyrus's smaller army took up a defensive position with the Euphrates River covering its right flank. Here were stationed the 10,000 nearest the river, along with peltasts and about 1,000 Persian cavalry to screen their right flank. The Persians themselves formed up the center and the left of Cyrus's force, with Cyrus himself occupying the very center of the army, which is the traditional position for a Persian commander to occupy, surrounded by 600 hand-picked horsemen. His personal courage was not in doubt, but it bordered on the reckless that he insisted on wearing no helmet, though he did have on a hat or a turban of some sort. He was armed like the rest of his cavalry. His body and horse and the chest of his horse were armored in mail, and he himself carried spears and a Greek-style sword. Xenophon describes vividly the approach of Artaxerxes' army. At first, only a dust cloud could be seen. Then the dust became so dense that it took on the appearance of a dark cloud, which blackened the plain between the two armies. Flashes of bronze and armor were seen, white corslets shining in the sun as the various national contingents gradually came into view. Egyptians with long wooden shields, rank upon rank of bowmen, and scythed chariots to the fore. The huge army advanced steadily and in unnerving silence. Cyrus rode up and down his line, issuing encouragement. He ordered Clearchus to charge the enemy center, since that is where the king would be located, surrounded by his 6,000 horse guard. "If we are victorious there," he shouted, "our whole task is complete." Clearchus, however, rather liked his position along the river and feared that if he moved toward the enemy center, he would be flanked on both sides. So he assured Cyrus that all would work out well, but he had no intention of moving away from the river's protection. As matters turned out, this decision was probably the wrong one. Artaxerxes' army was so vast that his center alone extended beyond Cyrus's left flank. The scythed chariots charged ineffectually. Then the Greeks struck up their pion and advanced straight ahead against the enemy's left wing. They began to run, clashing their spears against their shields, and, like the witnesses at the parade charge weeks before, the troops of the Persian left facing this terrifying onslaught turned tail and fled before contact was even made. The Greeks continued on in pursuit, delighted by their easy victory. Elsewhere, things were not going quite so well. Cyrus, when he saw the 10,000 advance straight ahead, must have realized Clearchus had no intention of attacking the center. Meanwhile, Artaxerxes, seeing that his line extended far beyond Cyrus's left, began moving to encircle his brother's force. Out of desperation, Cyrus charged with the 600 horse against Artaxerxes and his 6,000. This daring move was initially successful, and Cyrus came within sight of his brother. Ctesias, a Greek physician at the Persian court, left an eyewitness record of what happened next in his Persian history. This work is now lost, but it was available to the biographer Plutarch in the 2nd century AD, who provides a summary of it in his Life of Artaxerxes. In this instance, therefore, Plutarch is to be preferred over Xenophon, who was on the field, but far removed from Cyrus and Artaxerxes, since he was with the Greek force pursuing the fleeing Persian left. Here is what Ctesias has reported. "The brothers moved towards one another in silence. Cyrus hurled his spear at Artaxerxes and wounded him in the chest, a wound later treated by Ctesias. Artaxerxes, stricken, fell from his horse, regained his feet, and retired with Ctesias to a nearby hill. Cyrus ploughed on through Artaxerxes' men, now in disarray, crying out, 'Out of my way, beggars!' With Artaxerxes nowhere to be seen, some began to hail Cyrus as king. His victory seemed complete. But his reign lasted only moments. When Cyrus's royal headgear fell off, a soldier, not recognizing him, struck him in the face with a spear. Cyrus fell to the ground off his horse. He was helped to his feet, but then surrounded by some of Artaxerxes' camp followers and stabbed with a spear." As Plutarch comments, "Such is the story of Ctesias, in which, as with the blunt sword, he is slow in killing Cyrus, but he kills him at last." Xenophon's account, undoubtedly drawn from hearsay, is much briefer. "Cyrus, on seeing his brother in the fray, lost the run of himself and charged, shouting, 'I see the man!' Cyrus, as reported by Ctesias, hit Artaxerxes in the chest, but was himself hit in the face with a javelin. Then a duel ensued between the king and his brother, in which Cyrus was killed." So Artaxerxes killed Cyrus in Xenophon's version. Either way, Cyrus perished in his charge against Artaxerxes, that much is clear. With this development, the whole purpose of the march up country collapsed. Cyrus's Persians naturally fled, most notably a certain Areaeus on the left wing, whose contingents had played no part in the battle up to this point. Artaxerxes' centre and left, facing no opposition, advanced on to Cyrus's camp, where the troops gave themselves to plunder. Meanwhile, the 10,000 had continued their pursuit of the broken Persian left. Even as Artaxerxes and his remaining forces advanced to Cyrus's camp, each side thought that it had been victorious when news arrived of the other's existence. Xenophon says that the armies were 3.5 miles apart at this point, with their backs to each other. So they wheeled about and headed back towards their starting positions. Since both armies were now simply retracing their steps, the two armies eventually aligned and formed a single continuous line as they passed by. Rarely has so strange a situation been documented in the annals of military history. The explanation for it must lie in the difficulties of communication on the ancient battlefield. Men could march this way or that way, but it was difficult to get them to change directions in the midst of a march without losing cohesion and risking disaster. So rather than risk that, both sides just kept on marching straight ahead to the point where they were actually alongside each other. Yet somehow, both sides managed to wheel about and face the other. This was probably achieved by stopping and issuing new orders to the unit officers.
Xenophon actually has Clearchus taking advice on what to do next, which implies a pause of some sort. Thus it was that both armies once more confronted each other along the Euphrates, with Artaxerxes now lacking his original left wing, which had been driven off the field by the 10,000. For a second time then, the 10,000 struck up their pion and advanced into a charge, and for the second time the Persians broke and fled. Without a single blow being struck, the Persians retreated to a hill and formed up there. The Greeks pursued them and advanced and charged again, and for a third time the Persians fled in the face of this onslaught. As it grew dark, there was no sign of the enemy, so the Greeks made their way back to their camp, only to find it a mess. Exhausted from their exertions and hungry from lack of food since their provisions had been plundered, they lay down to sleep, puzzled that no word had come from Cyrus. The next day, heralds arrived from Artaxerxes, among them the son of Demaratus, the exiled Spartan king who had been an advisor to Xerxes during the Persian Wars and whose family had clearly made a home for themselves at the Persian court. The 10,000 were now informed that Cyrus was dead and their surrender was demanded. They had lost. The Persians insisted that the Greeks give up their arms. This demand was refused. So next, a truce was reached with Tissaphernes, who was acting as the king's spokesman. The 10,000 were guaranteed safe passage out of the Persian Empire in exchange for a promise not to pillage or forage in the lands that they passed through. The king would provide a guide and a market where the soldiers could acquire their provisions. The Greeks discussed the matter and agreed to these terms. Oaths were taken to seal the agreement. The situation now looked a little better. Lack of provisions prevented them from heading back northwest toward Turkey, so they began making their way up the Tigris River toward the southern shore of the Black Sea. Previously, the Greeks had linked up with Areaeus and the Persian remnant of Cyrus's army, and mutual oaths of assistance had been sworn. But as they marched up the Tigris, Areaeus and his Persians spent more and more time with them Tissaphernes and his Persians, to the point of encamping with them at night, some distance from the Greeks. Suspicions arose among the 10,000 that the Persians were making common cause against them. Clearchus requested a parley to allay these tensions. A conference was set up in the Persian camp, to which all five Greek generals and all 20 captains were invited. But when the Greeks arrived, the captains were killed and the generals arrested, in defiance of the truce and the oaths that had guaranteed it. All five generals, including Clearchus, were taken before Artaxerxes and then executed. Persian armies were notorious for imploding on the death of a leader. Remember what had happened after Mardonius fell at Plataea, as we reviewed in Lecture 12. So, I suppose, the Persians reckoned that with all their generals and most of their unit officers dead, the Greek mercenaries would surely just surrender. The reaction of the 10,000, however, was somewhat different. Assessing their options, they elected replacement generals, Xenophon among them, and determined to march home, even if it meant fighting all the way. And this, remarkably, they did. The main feature of the march is the adaptability of the Greek force. The 10,000 had no cavalry or missile troops, so they formed up in a hollow square, put the baggage and the camp followers, which included women and children, in the middle, and marched in this formation much of the way back home. The Persian use of light-armed missile units should have spelled their doom, since the Persians could hang back and kill from a distance, while the hoplites could not hope to catch mounted or light-armed troops on foot. At first, this is how the march played out, and serious casualties were incurred by the Greek side. But they adapted. Identifying some Rhodians and Cretans in their midst, they fitted them out as slingers and archers, and then drove off the Persian horse archers and javelineers. They also used some baggage animals to form a small unit of cavalry. Further refinements were also adopted as weaknesses in their square formation were revealed. After many tribulations, too many to go over here, the force emerged at the eastern end of the Black Sea. The scene is a memorable one. As the army ascended a mountain in the land of the Macrones in Armenia, Xenophon, who was stationed in the rear guard, heard a commotion coming from the front. He saw the units in front of him surging forward. Concerned that the enemy was attacking the vanguard, he grabbed a horse and rode forward to see what was happening. As he approached the front, he heard the cry, "The sea, the sea! Thalassa, thalassa!" The Greeks were a maritime people, and with the sight of the sea before their eyes, they knew they could make it back to the Aegean. They were saved. A few days later, the army reached the coast at a place called Trapezus, and then marched along the north coast of Turkey, plundering and raiding as it went, since they were still inside the Persian Empire, so it was fair game. And its adventures were not yet over. When they reached the Hellespont, the 10,000 entered the employ of a Thracian king and only ended their journey at Pergamum in 399 BC. Here they were absorbed into a Spartan army that was campaigning at the time in Asia. Of the 13,000 troops who had started out with Cyrus, 8,600 made it to the Black Sea. The rest had perished from enemy action, exposure and disease. This remnant, however, participated in the comeuppance of the despised Tissaphernes. In 395 BC, he was defeated by the Spartans with the 10,000 in their employ, captured and executed. Xenophon himself was exiled from Athens for his close ties to the Spartans and his anti-democratic politics, and he lived out his life in Sparta and then Corinth, devoting himself to writing history, philosophy, biography, and treatises in politics, agriculture, horsemanship, and hunting. He died sometime in the 350s. Artaxerxes II was one of Persia's longest ruling kings, sitting on the throne for 45 years. The greatest crisis of his long reign was the revolt of his brother Cyrus. He expired in 359 BC, shortly before Xenophon, amid increasingly vicious jostling among his 115 sons over the succession. The March of the 10,000 is as remarkable and romantic to us today as it was to the Greeks of old. In all, they had marched nearly 3,000 miles in the course of 15 months, much of it through hostile territory and after the leaders had been murdered. We know that various published accounts of the march were circulating in ancient times, so that its exploits were widely celebrated in the Greek world. The episode has been believed since antiquity to hold numerous significant lessons about Greeks and Persians, primarily in the military sphere. Pan-Hellenist thinkers, who advocated united Greek action against Persia, deduced an essential Persian weakness from their failure to stop the 10,000. Orators like Isocrates of Athens, who lived between 436 and 338 BC, believed the 10,000 clearly demonstrated that Persia could not withstand Greek arms, even on Persian soil. Many modern commentators follow Isocrates in arguing that the episode proves an inherent superiority of Greek arms over those of the East. One particularly forceful advocate of this position states, and I quote, "To envision the equivalent of a Persian 10,000 is impossible," unquote. By way of illustration, a contrast is drawn between the fate of the Persians after Plataea, slaughtered or enslaved, and the organized breakout staged by the 10,000. But this analogy, it seems to me, is very misleading. The Persian army at Plataea was defeated, broken, and scattered. The 10,000 at Cunaxa were not. Organized retreat cannot be expected from a defeated and demoralized army, even a Greek one, as the Athenians had shown in their last terrible retreat from Syracuse in 413 BC. The situation of the 10,000 was just too different from that of the Persian survivors at Plataea to justify broad conclusions about the relative strength of Eastern and Western arms. Other factors were involved. First, the decentralized nature of Persian imperial administration helped the 10,000. As they marched, they passed from one semi-autonomous satrapy or client kingdom into another. So responsibility for chasing them kept shifting. For instance, once the retreating Greeks entered the mountainous realm of the Carduchi, probably the Kurds, in northern Iraq, Tissaphernes and his Persians stopped chasing them. The Carduchi were only nominally under Persian control, and had Tissaphernes followed the Greek army into their turf, his men would have been targets for attack just as much as the Greeks were. In reality, no concerted, sustained attempt was made by the Persians, monolithically conceived, to annihilate the 10,000. Rather, it was a task delegated to the regional rulers through whose territory the Greeks marched. Next, from a Persian perspective, the 10,000 were just a bunch of troublesome Greeks who wanted out. While it is true that Artaxerxes may have wished to punish them for taking part in Cyrus's revolt, it was not vital to his rule that he do so, as indeed was proven by the long reign that he subsequently enjoyed. It was crucial, however, that he not be seen to condone their actions or to treat with them. The king had saved his throne at Cunaxa. He hardly needed to keep his vast army in the field for several more months, at considerable expense, to annihilate a pesky band of Greeks who were scampering home. From his perspective, then, chasing them off Persian lands was sufficient. Finally, while a Hellenized army did indeed conquer the Persian Empire under Alexander the Great, as we'll see in the lecture after next, it was one so differently trained, equipped, organized, and deployed as to make simplistic military comparisons with the 10,000 facile. So while there's a kernel of validity in the military effectiveness analysis, it is neither the whole story nor even the main point taught by the episode of the 10,000. The clearest lessons, rather, lie not in the military, but in the cultural and political spheres. Throughout the expedition, major decisions were discussed among the Greek generals, course of action determined, and then that determination presented to the men for approval. The 10,000 thus resembled a Greek city-state without a territory, a body of citizens arriving at decisions through discussion and debate. Even under terrific pressure, the 10,000 stuck to these decision-making principles. Generals had authority to command, but it was an authority grounded in the consensus of the commanded. The Persians, in contrast, danced to the tune of their divinely sanctioned king, whose will was the iron law of the land. Major decisions by subordinates required approval from above. All plans, whether undertaken under orders or on local initiative, were executed with a view to how they might play at court. Persian action was wholly oriented toward the throne. So even if, in acting this way, the Greeks were doing little more than behaving like Greeks and the Persians like Persians, the contrast in the cultural universes they occupied could not have been more sharply drawn.
This is G. Bernard Owens. Many people know Don Rickles as an outstanding comic. Few people, however, know that there is a serious side to Don Rickles. He has many thoughts. Thoughts of people, life, philosophy. Here to elicit those thoughts, an eminent panel of experts. The questioning begins.
Mr. Rickles, there's been an outbreak of plane hijacking on planes headed for Miami winding up in Cuba. Do you think this is a permanent situation we're going to have to live with?
No, I think that'll stop as soon as Havana gets enough of their waiters back. Seems all the waiters were working the big hotels, the Eden Rock and Deauville and Fontainebleau's, and they're all there. Now they're taking the planes going back to Havana so Castro can have those hot meals again instead of just running up in the woods sucking on an old rock.
On the island of Formosa, Chiang Kai-shek has been there for several years now with 700,000 troops, and we've been supporting this operation. What do you think of this situation on Formosa?
I think it's great. After all, the restaurants would have a definite supply of pork fried rice with him over there. Yes. And there, I think General Chiang Kai-shek is a great asset. He just sits on the island all day long going, "Muyamalai, humayaman." They go, "Yeah, dummy, we understand." And they give him a fortune cookie and he goes away. He's a real yo-yo. But I think Formosa's doing a great job just keeping the island in the middle of the water just to screw up the ship traffic. It's called screwing up ship traffic.
Mr. Rickles, one of the most controversial subjects right now are the student protests. Would you give us your comment on that, please?
I think what the kids are doing today is they have a right to demonstrate, and I believe in what they say. They have a right to their thinking. You know, sometimes if they start burning the president of the school on a stick, there's no humor there, you know.
Mr. Rickles, you being an authority on world affairs, and since the Paris peace talks are still in progress, do you have any solution for bringing them to a climax?
I think they should get a girl and have her stand on a table and do some tricks. I don't know how they're going to work this out. A couple of Vietnamese come down from Hanoi after a hot evening playing Mahjong, and then get that, what's his name, that General Key, who's got about 18 broads in the back of a Chevy. He's walking around with his kerchief around his neck going, "Want peace." Well, that's the answer. We all do. Sometimes we can't make a deal for it. I think the United States has done a great thing. Governor Harriman, I understand, twice they woke him up at the table, dozed off and fell into his vest. President Johnson doesn't worry too much about that because he'll be out at the ranch saying, "Here, Smokey, jump up on Daddy." He'll be with his dog while his wife is planting anything that moves. And the kids will be running around going, "Our dad is rich. We got our own ponies."
Mr. Rickles, where do you stand in the Arab-Israeli war?
In the middle. No, being Jewish, I would take a wild guess and say I'm on the Israeli side.
Oh.
I could have been on the Arab side, but who wants to walk around in rags watching your sheep die? Well, I do care. Moshe Dayan, who was at my house the other night and could only see one side of the table, kept just having salmon, and there was tuna on the other side.
I understand you got married rather late in life. Is that true?
That is true.
Yes. Would you give us your opinion on marriage, please?
Well, marriage is great. It's okay. Now that I'm married, it's like having the boat at the dock, and you know it's there, so why break the cord, you know? It was a lot more fun the old way, you know, with a stocking on your head, and she has to guess who you are. But marriage is nice if you're that lonely. Now, take you, for instance. You're married a couple of years, and I think it's a big mistake because you don't have looks or any particular ability going for it. At least my wife has laughed. She puts a cigarette on her navel and makes it puff. So marriage is a beautiful thing, you know, if you're that lonely. And it's better than laying in a dam watching a beaver eat your jacket or something.
Do you have any comments for the American people on the stock market at this time?
I don't really care about the stock market, and you don't care either. That was written on the paper, so you, like a hockey puck, asked me. I hope you live in a gypsy camp and a werewolf bites you on the neck and you become what you are now, a girl with no looks.
Why are there so many Italian singers like Vic Damone and Jerry Vale and Buddy Greco?
Because they all had wagons and they used to sing in the street. That's the way from their ancestry, you know. Get your knives! You know, that became a song. Guanda Bella, get your knives. Well, Italian guys, you know, what else do they have to do? They have no jobs. They sit around crushing grapes and you sing to relax yourself. And most of them, you know, Jerry Vale is a guy that never had a job. I met him in Jersey, hanging around the woods in Englewood. You know, hitting pine trees. And somebody said, why don't you hum? He went, the hum of pine trees. He became a singer. Most Italian guys never work, you know. They're either at a hold-up or they're humming.
Do you think much about dying?
Yes, doing this album. Doing this album, I've thought about dying. Dying, I figure when I go, I'll have about 40 cars at Riverside Chapel in New York with a motorcycle escort. I do plan to have my uncle to show up in his bathrobe. He dresses for nothing. I plan to have my aunt throw herself on the casket because my father owed her money. I do think my wife probably will be there and not know what the event is. That's the kind of wife I got. She'll probably look up and say, did he die? I think in death we can make humor in death. You know, if you die, it would strike me funny. Because you're the kind of guy that if you die, there's a lot of humor there. Because what did they lose? You know, some guy that hangs around a record company saying, you want to see my ball of wax? So who needs you?
How would you like to go, Mr. Rickles?
I figure when I die, I want to be hit quick. You know, why hang around and have the eyes dance a little bit and have the family lean over trying to pick up where you kept the money? You know what I mean? It's murder when they all lean over the bed. Where's the money? You know, and they're cutting off the oxygen pump. So I just want to go have the shoes turn up and have a guy go, that's it, Harry. You know, put me on a dump truck and take me out to the park.
Could you give us some capsule descriptions of some people like George Burns?
George Burns is a great, great man. He's an older man who likes young girls. And we've gotten him a little doll, and he just sits in his room now and tickles it.
Ronald Reagan?
Ronald Reagan still sits in Sacramento waiting for his Death Valley Day checks. Ronald Reagan runs around looking for Lola Albright and all those Warner Brothers stars. Still has over his office desk an 8x10 glossy of some of the biggies, Sidney Greenstreet, Zachary Scott. Sits in his house all day rerunning Warner Brothers pictures trying to figure out why Frank Albertson got bigger parts than him.
You know, Jack Warner.
Jack Warner is a multimillionaire who sits in the living room by himself, depressed, with Indian nuts in his hand, just listening to noises.
Jack Lemmon.
He walks around trying to figure out how to knock off Walter Matthau.
If you were to sum up Hugh Downs in maybe two sentences, how would you do it?
Dull all the time.
Warren Beatty in two sentences.
Grab anything that moves.
Jackie Gleason.
Jackie Gleason's okay. We ought to put stripes on his belly, a cord in his navel, and let him float over a carnival.
Mr. Rickles, what role do you think Spiro Agnew will play in the new administration?
Getting the Japanese people their freedom.
Yeah. Ho Chi Minh,
that's on Fairfax. That's a wonderful spot, fried rice, egg foo young, and a little mantan duck, Ho Chi Minh.
King Hussein of Jordan.
Well, he's got his problems, you know. Since the war, he can't get any more holly.
Do you regard Doris Day as a sex symbol?
Would I regard Doris Day as a sex symbol? You're a definite moron. I'll tell you that right now.
Edie and Steve, that's Edie Gourmet and Steve Lawrence, probably one of the happiest married couples. Could you tell us why you think they're so happily married and still in a competitive business like show business?
Between the two of them, they don't have any voice, so they have no competition. They just lay around at home and wait for Jewish holidays, and then they go out on the sidewalk and do Maccabee, fighting Maccabee songs. They're two dummy kids that I never liked, and I definitely feel they're fooling the business, and they should get out of it. They really should. They're annoying.
I'd like to ask you about probably the most famous couple in entertainment, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. Do you know these people?
Wildies. Richard Burton is great. He's a Welshman, you know. She found him in a coal mine. His pick went dead. He was in there chopping away at rocks and nothing much was happening. And she came down and said, "Hello, Rich." And he said, "Oh, don't let the spot on the wall." And he did his whole poem and took him out of the cave. But Rich and Elizabeth, they don't have to... I don't know how they get time for movies because they're both, you know, kind of exciting and wild. They always have the image with sex. I saw them once in New York, you know. They were standing on the corner, and it was snowing, and we had to get the firemen to separate them. Just froze together. That's how wild they are. They're a wild couple.
And how about Carol Burnett?
She keeps showing me an 8x10 glossy of her mouth. She has a tremendous mouth, and she, when she breathes, between Streisand's nose and Carol's mouth, if they were put together, you could have a deadly animal on your hands. Something that could hurt somebody.
Lady, I'd like your opinion on, please, Anna May Wong.
You just gave the opinion. Anna May Wong is a great woman.
More, please.
Oh! Anna May Wong is a lot of fun. You know, if you're living in Chinatown and you're old and you need a guide to get back in your car. I don't know too much about Anna May Wong. You know, you're a real moron, Anna May Wong. What do I know about Anna May Wong? How about Juana Baxter?
I know Robert Goulet is a friend of yours, and you know him personally. Could you tell us a few personal notes on Mr. Goulet?
Well, Robert Goulet is not a person, really. He has a skate key in his back. He's a doll. Robert Goulet is one of the great robots of our time. I spent an evening with Robert Goulet at his home. He wore his smoking jacket and circled the candles for about an hour and a half. He's 31, but he stood on the couch without his booties on, singing happy birthday to himself. Robert Goulet is retarded.
How can you say those vicious things when he says so many nice things about you?
Well, what is he going to say about me? Where is he going? The man just sings alone in his room while Carol Lawrence keeps yelling, "Maria, Maria." No, these are my friends, and I say bad things about them because I laugh at them as they will laugh at me. Because if I said nice things about them, they'd probably call me up and want to hang out with me. So it's better this way, that I say bad things and then I don't get any call.
I'm Elijah Killen again, thanking you sons of America for loving freedom, and please feel free to contribute any content you can. We hope there will be many more episodes and then we can grow this format as well as refresh its content on a more regular basis. God is the victory, God is the peace. Sons of America 001 at gmail.com.